From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For all their technological abilities, the German army still relied on horses during World War II. Nearly 3 million were part of the German war effort. And this was a time when a lot of countries associated their military skill with the quality of their cavalry. The writer Elizabeth Letts says when Hitler invaded Poland in 1939, effectively starting the war, he had built into the blueprint a plan to rebuild Poland's horse-breeding industry. Letts' new book is about that effort. Really, it's about the beautiful white horses stolen by the Nazis. The idea was to breed the perfect military machine, a master race of horses. Her book tells the story of the American soldiers who risked their lives to rescue the animals. The book is called The Perfect Horse. And we'll talk about it after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Elizabeth Letts' new book plays out as one era of warfare replaces another. World War II was the first truly mechanized war where machines replaced horses. But as she says in the book, for centuries, men had measured their military might by the worth of their horses. And as the war began, horses were still seen as important to the effort. If not in practical terms, horses meant other things, too. Symbolism and ceremony and, for the Germans, breeding. The Nazis believed you could purify the bloodlines of a horse like you could a human. And so part of Letts' book is about the attempt to create the ideal war horse. But the book is also about this thrilling rescue effort to take back the magnificent Lipizzaner stallions stolen by the Nazis. Her book is called The Perfect Horse, The Daring U.S. Mission to Rescue the Priceless Stallions Kidnapped by the Nazis. And today in the program, she's joining us to talk about it. Elizabeth Letts is a writer, a lifelong equestrian. We'll talk a little bit about that. Among her other books is The $80 Champion, the story of a horse saved from the slaughterhouse to become a champion jumper. She's joining us today from the studios of NPR in Culver City, California. And Elizabeth Letts, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I guess we should begin with your own connection to horses. You were a champion rider when you were younger. And one of the things that I've read interviews where you've talked about this connection that a rider has to a horse. I wanted to start with that, if we could, and just how that impacted the way you wrote this story.
Well, I started in riding horses when I was very small. I lived in a town where people kept their horses at home. It was suburbia with stables in the backyard, which was kind of a fad in building developments back in the 50s. They were sort of like ranches in California. And I always had horses in my backyard and started riding them. And then riding really became my passion as I was growing up. I would come home from school, get on my horse or sometimes more than one horse and ride for hours every day. And I used to think a lot about that connection between myself and the horse, how I got to the point that I felt that I could speak to my horse without really knowing how I was transmitting that information. When you're riding, you give a horse cues or aids, let's say to how it knows that it's supposed to trot or supposed to pick up a canter or halt. And you use different cues, your weight and your legs and the reins to pull back and your voice sometimes. But when you get really good, you get the feeling that you almost aren't aware of what you're doing, that somehow the horse understands that you're speaking a common language. Mm. And so my own experience, having known what that felt like, really I bring that to the table when I'm talking about the relationship that men have with their horses or had in these stories that I tell.
There are a number of, really throughout the book, there are these moments, and we'll get to this one image that you create about this dressage competition in the 1936 Olympics. But throughout the book, there are these incredibly descriptive moments when you're riding in in such detail about the movement of horses during these maneuvers or during these ceremonies or during these moments of drama. Knowing how to ride and how it all works must have really influenced the way you wrote these stories.
Absolutely. I think that had another writer decided to tell the story, they might have told it in a different way. Because what I looked at when I was doing my research, I was trying to understand the men who were interacting with the horses and trying to understand what it was that was driving them. Mm. And what I realized was that these were people who had grown up with horses even more than what I had experienced myself, that they were so steeped in the culture of horses from the time they were young men. It had been their primary occupation. And the bond that they had with the horses and the way that they understood what the horses could do and how they felt about them was something that I was trying to communicate that to a reader who perhaps doesn't have that experience with horses.
Yeah. It is the one thing that connects pretty much all of the people in the story. On either side of this horrible, brutal conflict is their connection to horses. And that's kind of interesting. That's the one sort of common thing that they share.
Yes, absolutely. And that, to me, was so fascinating because you took these people, and in my story, you have people who are wearing the uniforms of a number of different countries. Mm-hmm. You have Germans, you have Americans, and you have Poles, and you have Czechs, and you have people who are on opposite sides of this brutal, obviously terrible, terrible conflict that's going on, where man is expressing its worst inhumanity to man. But the men who had the connection with the horses, they had something else to bring to the table. Mm. And that is that they had been trained to honor the horse above themselves. And somehow that common shared code of the cavalry managed to help them find a way to bridge their differences.
You write a little bit later in the book that the memory of this rescue, which we'll talk about, and although I'm worried about giving too much away, and I'll sort of take your guidance on all of that. But you say this memory of the rescue became kind of tucked away, is how you put it, with the rest of war souvenirs after all of this played out. Not a lot of people knew about it. I don't know if anyone has written about it necessarily. How did you learn about the story?
Well, the way that I learned about it was really by accident, and I find that that tends to be how I find my best stories. As a historian, I love nothing more than sitting in an archive leafing through random papers. And while I was researching my last book, The $80 Champion, I was looking at some pamphlets that had to do with the United States Cavalry, which only touched just very tangentially on my last book. But I was just interested, and I found a tiny little pamphlet. When I say pamphlet, it was almost more like just a mimeographed, a couple of pages that were folded together. It had a very, handmade look to it. And it said, a parade of European horses. And it was on an army base in Virginia. And the date was April 7th, 1946. And so when I opened this pamphlet, not knowing what it was, I saw the names of these horses. They all had foreign names, and they were either Arabians from Poland or Lipizzaner. Yeah. And because I'm a horse person, I know something in particular about the Lipizzaner. I knew that they were the famed white horses of Austria. Yeah. So I didn't understand why these horses were on parade in Virginia on a U.S. Army base and why they were, right after the war. I had no idea what they were doing there. That made no sense to me. And to top it off, what really intrigued me was that this was a piece of paper that obviously had been in the hands of someone who had been at the parade that day. And the penciled in notes were still there. Mm. They had written things like magnificent and the most extraordinary horses in the world. Well, that was enough to whet my appetite and think that I needed to really dig in and see what the story was behind this pamphlet.
And so, as I guess it works, one thing leads to another and another, and then you find this story of this rescue. You must have been stunned. like, well, here's my book.
I was stunned. And yes. Well, and I have to say that there was, in fact, a movie made by Walt Disney that came out in 1962 called The Miracle of the White Stallions. And there are many horse aficionados who remember that movie. It was a little bit before my time. And so I had never seen it or heard of it. And it did tell the story of, sort of a part of the story, but in typical Disney fashion, it really didn't tell the real historical story.
Yeah. Well, let's jump in. And I guess we have to start in 1936, as you do in the book, with the Olympic Games in Berlin. And one of the central figures in the book, maybe the central figure, a man named Alois Podaisky? Is that?
Podaisky, yes.
Let's talk about him first. Loyal Austrian. It's a great story of, as you tell it, maybe start with the fact that he's competing with his horse, Nero. And how he's rescued Nero. Like, Podaisky was a reject, as you say, who saves Nero from also being rejected. I mean, they had this really strong connection. Tell us about Podaisky, if you would.
Yes. Well, Alois Podaisky was born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he was born in, I believe, 1898. And he had grown up as a young man, as many of the people in my story did, interestingly, dreaming of joining the cavalry. And if you can think back to the early 20th century, there was nothing that was more extraordinary than the cavalry, their uniforms and their horses and their parades. And so he had wanted to join the cavalry. And so when World War I broke out, he, in fact, did join the cavalry. He went and served in a cavalry unit where he was fighting in some of the worst fighting of the war. He was very severely wounded, and he was injured in his neck, which when he came back from the war, he had lost his ability to speak. It wasn't really clear to me in researching how much of that was due to the injury and how much of it was what we would now call PTSD. But he describes going through a very, very dark time where really nothing in the world meant anything to him, and he was unable to speak. And it was only when he was able to reconnect with horses that he started to feel like he was coming back to himself. He very much felt that his work with horses was really the thing that had saved his life. And so after he became involved in the cavalry, and he was a cavalry instructor and a cavalry rider, and he wanted to be a jumper rider. He wanted to jump horses, but he had a fall and he injured his back. And at that point, he was told that he was through because he couldn't even really mount on the horse correctly. He needed to be given a hand up and his back was stiff. But he was determined that he wasn't going to give up on riding. And so he switched to the discipline of dressage. And those who are not familiar with dressage, it's kind of like people call it ballet on horseback, where horses do very intricate maneuvers, but there's no jumping involved. So Podaisky, being a cavalry officer, he didn't have the means to go out and purchase a very fine horse. He had to take a horse among the horses that they had, and he came across a horse by the name of Nero, who had been rejected. He was seen as being not pretty enough, not appropriate to be a cavalry mount, to be a competitive horse, to be a jumper. So nobody really wanted him. Podaisky took this horse on and began to train him in the art of dressage. And he after several years, became one of the leading riders, if not the leading rider, in this sport going into the Olympic Games in 1936 in Berlin.
Oh, the thing that I hadn't realized is, as you say, the equestrian events, at least in 1936 in those days, they were mostly for the military.
Yes.
And in fact, it's so interesting also that the Olympics itself was, George Patton comes into this idea a little bit in the story, because the games were about sort of military discipline and military performance. It's something I hadn't really thought of.
Yes. Well, I thought this was so intriguing because as I started to research the story, I found that all roads seemed to lead back to the Olympics, because the modern Olympic Games was the first time that the world's horses had been gathered side by side, and so that they could be compared. And it was actually the Olympics, the first modern Olympics in Stockholm in 1912, so this was before World War I, where the world's horses were gathered for the first time, and people from the United States and from Germany and from other countries started to be able to look at the horses side by side in these equestrian events, which were in fact limited only to equestrian officers. And what happened with this first Olympics in 1912 was it started what was almost like an arms race for horses.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at that from the 2016 perspective, that sounds ludicrous. But if you think back to the early 20th century, the horse was still considered a primary source of military might. So when you got the military riders and their horses together on the stage of the Olympics, and you had them compete in these equestrian events, it was almost as if you were looking at tiny little war games where the country's military might and the military prestige was very much on the line. Now, if you look at 1936, which is where I start my story in Berlin, obviously, we know in retrospect what was just around the corner. It was the beginning of World War II and the Nazi expansion, et cetera. So those 1936 games were extremely fraught in terms of the importance and the tension that went into these military equestrian events.
You call it a dress rehearsal for a much larger cataclysm that was just over the horizon.
Indeed.
Yeah. And so would you just mention Podaisky's, I don't know how do you performance with Nero. It's beautifully written in the book, and they must have had a connection, and he must have had a kind of gift. Dressage, you said, was descended from these intricate military maneuvers that were developed, you know, anciently.
Yes.
Would you just tell about that one performance? And I'm wondering how you were able to sort of bring that to life.
So the performance of Podaisky in this dressage competition on his horse Nero takes place in Berlin on a location that was called Mayfield. It was just adjacent to the big Olympic stadium where the main track and field events took place. So you could see it in the distance. And you've got a picture that you've got the giant Nazi swastika scarlet banners are spaced evenly around the perimeter of these venues, and you've got this field, and in the field there are risers. So there's quite a large crowd. I think there were more than 20,000 people spectating, and the dressage arena was laid out. It's a rectangle, and it has a very low fence, and into this rectangle, a rider comes alone and has to perform a prescribed series of movements with the horse. And these are movements that a horse actually could perform if it was in the wild. Horses naturally have these very beautiful movements, sometimes a very elevated trot with their neck arched, and it's something that stallions do to show off to other stallions. But in order to get a horse to perform that on command, it takes 5, 10, 15 years of painstaking daily training. So Podaisky rides into the ring with Nero, and he enters at a gallop in the middle of this center of the arena with all of the banners and the flags and the crowd. The horse has to stop on a dime, and Podaisky will salute to the judges who are down at the end of the arena. He then loosens his reins till he's almost giving his horse the complete freedom, and he then has to walk, do what's called a free walk, which is really difficult for a horse when they're, if you imagine, horses are naturally fearful of new things, and this is a obviously very unusual environment with the flags and the people and the crowds, etc. And he goes on, and he does these movements. Sometimes a horse will be doing what's called a pirouette, and that's where they have to canter in a circle around their hind legs, or they may do what's called a half pass, where the horse is trotting but also moving laterally. They can do flying changes where they're cantering and they change the lead so that one leg is leading and then the other leg's leading. Each one of these is extraordinarily difficult to do and requires a total cooperation between the horse and the rider. And in addition, if you can picture in your mind that Podaisky on his mount doesn't appear to really be moving at all. So whatever it is that he's doing to guide his horse through these movements is invisible to the average person who's watching.
Must have been amazing. But controversially, he comes in third. Loses out to the Germans, of course.
He does.
But you want to say anything about that? I guess it's hard to sort of pin this thing down, but you do mention that it seemed clear that the German judge saw how well he had done and seemed to be changing his marks.
Well, if you think about the circumstance that they're in, as I said, these are seen as military competitions. They had judges from several different countries who were sitting and observing this ride. And each one of them, they give marks for each individual movement. And it's subjective in the way that judging, let's say, gymnastics or figure skating would be.
Yeah.
Podaisky himself was the one who had claimed that the results that he later heard that one of the judges had changed, the German judge had changed his marks when he saw that Podaisky was going to come in first. And I think if you look at the context of the entire games, that equestrian competition in 1936 has gone down in the annals of history as being one of the most controversial. The Germans won all of the gold team and individual medals, which has never been repeated before or since. And you can imagine the pressure that was on the judges to give a result that would be acceptable to the Nazis who were in charge of the Olympics. So you never know for sure, but that was Podaisky's own report.
Elizabeth Letts is with us. Her new book is called The Perfect Horse, The Daring U.S. Mission to Rescue the Priceless Stallions Kidnapped by the Nazis. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the horses in World War II. And these were also the famous Lipizzaner stallions who were kidnapped by the Nazis during the war, hidden in a secret farm. The Nazis wanted a purified horse like they wanted purified humans. The idea was to create the ideal war horse. The writer Elizabeth Letts has a new book which tells this story. It's called The Perfect Horse. She's joining us today to talk about it. All right, let's talk about another character, fascinating guy, Gustav Rau, German horse expert, an expert on breeding, really, more than anything else. And he has this obsession, wants to make German horses the best horses in the world. Tell us about Gustav Rau.
Well, Gustav Rau got his start, just as some of the other people that we mentioned did, at the 1912 Olympics in Stockholm. He went there as a equestrian journalist. And when he got there, he felt that the German horses really didn't measure up. And so after that, Rau became a very important proponent in Germany of improving the breeding of German horses and also improving their general animal husbandry and getting more people involved in the sport of riding, particularly in rural areas. After World War I, the Germans' horse industry was really decimated. Yeah. Many, many of their horses had been killed in the war. And one thing that I found interesting that I didn't know was that as part of their reparations after World War II, Germany had to sell some of export horses. Mm. And so they didn't have a lot of horses. And Gustav Rau was one of the major people who said, we're going to build up the German horse industry again, and we're going to make the German horses the pride of Germany. And he was seen in a very positive light. But as it came into the 1930s with the rise of the National Socialists, it ended up that some of the theories about the eugenic theories that were applied to people that had to do with the purity of blood really were coming from observations that had been made about the breeding of horses. Right. So you have to understand that the breeding of horses, and for special purposes, racehorses and military horses, was something that had been very, very advanced compared to the state of knowledge of the science. So we didn't know what DNA was. We didn't really know how traits were passed along. And yet we had managed to really improve the horse, make it bigger and faster and stronger and et cetera. And so with a figure like Gustav Rau, he was an expert in horse breeding. And he had these theories that were kind of a hodgepodge of some science that maybe wasn't that developed and personal observation and seat of the pants. And as the National Socialists came into power, there started to be a dovetailing between these ideas about how to breed a really good horse that started to be applied to human beings, and the same idea of purity of blood that was popular with the National Socialists made the horse breeders and the Nazis sort of go hand in glove with each other in a very strange way.
Yeah. One of the things you write about is that some of the breeders had these ideas that a horse, and I wanted you to sort of take me through this, the horse was a product of its local environment.
Yes.
Take me through that. I found that really interesting.
Well, it was really interesting. So what I found was that the traditional way of looking at horse breeding was very much how we might think today of something like artisanal cheese or maybe wine. Something, the idea that the environment in which the horse was raised was going to create the features of the horse. So if you take the white Lipizzaner, for example, that horse was originally bred in a place called Lipica, which is in current day Slovenia. And it had a hard, rocky soil. And the Lipizzaner, one of the things that they were known for was that they had strong hooves. And so the belief was that the horse's hooves were strong because they were raised in this rocky plain that strengthened their hooves. And the idea was that if you then took these, even if they were purebred Lipizzaner, if you took them out of Lipizza and you tried to breed them somewhere else that had soft soil, for example, that you would find that they would start to be born with soft hooves.
How did it connect to sort of the Nazi concept? Because the Nazis had this ideology known as blood and land.
Yes.
Did they make a connection there?
Well, where they made the connection was not in this idea that the horses were a product of the land, that their hooves would be, softened if they moved, et cetera. But they espoused what they believed was a more modern view. Mm. And in some senses, there was some truth to this idea that the way that traits were passed on, were that they were not passed on from the environment itself, that they were passed from, from parent to offspring.
Right.
But they didn't know what the mechanism was. And so there was a thought that the mechanism was this, was a substance that was called germplasm. There was a German scientist, Weissmann, who thought that there was some substance, something that was being passed on from parent to child that would determine what characteristics they have. And the idea with this germplasm was that the germplasm had to stay pure and intact, that it could be corrupted. And if it was corrupted, then the offspring would instead of coming with the same characteristics, that maybe the offspring would have some kind of problem or it would be degraded. Mm. It was as if it was this precious thing that could be degraded if you weren't careful with the way that you bred. And so that was the modern way of thinking. And if you think this through now, you understand that the idea that you have to have like a pure blood was this idea that if you bred something into a bloodline that could corrupt this germplasm, and then the germplasm would never go back. And so that's where there was an overlap. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting was that there was this experiment. It was done by Weissmann, and it was he took six successive generations of mice, and he cut off the tails of each generation in order to show that just because you cut off the tail of a mouse, that it wouldn't eventually produce a tailless mouse.
Right. What was going on in the U.S. in terms of the way they were breeding their horses? Because you say the Americans had kind of a different principle than the idea of pure-bloodedness. They kind of had this different approach. And sort of this gets us to the Army's so-called remount division. I wanted you to talk about that, too, because it's an important part of the story.
Well, there were really two prevailing ideas about horse breeding in the United States. The pure-blooded idea was certainly alive and well in the breeding of thoroughbreds. The American thoroughbred descended from the English thoroughbred was very much a controlled bloodline. They believed that the horses had to be pure-blooded or they would not be considered thoroughbreds. And those horses were part of the sort of elite horses. But we had another model in the United States, which was the breeding of standardbreds, which were the trotting horses. And the trotting horses were, they were bred to meet a standard. And the standard was the ability to trot 1 mile in a certain amount of time. I believe it was 2 minutes and 5 seconds. I may be getting that wrong, though. And so in that model, the idea was you breed to try to create a horse that can do a particular thing, as opposed to you obsess about, you know, keeping the closed bloodline. So we had both of those. And the American Army was engaged in horse breeding because the idea was that we needed to have high-quality horses available for requisitioning if there was a war. Yeah. The American Army Remount Service was breeding horses, and their method of breeding horses did not really follow the German method, that there wasn't such an emphasis on purity of blood. Rather, they were trying to breed to a breed standard, so it was almost more similar to the way that standardbreds were bred. So they would take a variety of different horses of different breeds, but they would try to create from those breeds a horse that met the Army specifications for performance.
Let's talk about Hank Reed, Colonel Hank Reed. Tell us his part in the story. Introduce us to him.
Well, Hank Reed was born on Christmas Day in 1900 on a farm outside Richmond, Virginia. And one of the things that charmed me so much about Hank Reed was that he went to school in downtown Richmond. So in order to get to the train that would take him to school, he would ride his horse from his farm, leave it in a paddock by the train station, take the train into school, go to school, and then on the way back, he would do the reverse and ride home. He, like many of my other characters, said when he was 7 years old that he wanted to join the cavalry.
Right.
And he came from a very wealthy family. His father owned a large textile business in Richmond, and it was expected that Hank would go into the family business. But Hank had no interest in the family business. Mm-hmm. Hank wanted to be a cavalryman. He went to West Point, where he excelled in horseback riding. And then when he graduated, he went into the cavalry and spent his career in the equestrian world. He was an ace polo player. He was on the War Department polo team in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. He was one of the Army's top riders. They had an elite equestrian program where every year they would choose the top 8 riders in the Army and put them through this intensive equitation course at Fort Riley. He was an alternate for the Olympic team in 1932. So he was... Mm-hmm. He was, you know, I say he was sort of the last of a dying breed. This was a man who had been trained to be one of the world's elite riders.
And his role is so interesting, I have to say, before we sort of get to the rescue part of the story, he's a cavalryman without a horse in Europe. I mean, and that's such a strange irony, I think. But it's sort of an image in this story.
It is. I mean, so this is really what struck me as I was writing the story is this was a, if you think about the horse as a victim of technological change, really. So that it had been at least a millennia that we had been using horses for warfare. But now we find ourselves in 1942 in the United States, and we are almost at the very bitter end of this long, long tradition. Mm. So you take Hank Reed. Here's a man who has been trained in the Army tradition. And I personally did not know when I started writing this book that Americans were still training on horseback during World War II, after Pearl Harbor. I had no idea that that was the case. But Hank was one of those people. He was still training mounted soldiers right up through 1942. But in 1942, the 2nd Cavalry, which was one of the United States' most prestigious mounted units, probably the most prestigious mounted unit, was unhorsed.
Yeah.
They gave all their horses away, and appended to the end of the name of the 2nd Cavalry were the letters M-E-C-Z, which stood for mechanized. And so just on the eve of leaving for war, the 2nd Cavalry was now a mechanized unit, and they were going to gallop into battle on jeeps and in tanks.
You mentioned Gustav Rau in the book as being he sort of creates this vast kingdom of horses for the Third Reich. Rau's the emperor of this vast kingdom. And he travels all over Europe evaluating and purchasing horses. You put purchasing in quotations, which I gather means that they just basically took what they wanted.
I mean, they said that the Germans said that they purchased them, but you have to understand that this is an occupying army
exactly,
who could take
exactly.
whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
Yes.
And of course, you say soon his interest comes to center on the Lipizzaner stallions. Gives us a chance, before we head into a break, to talk about the Spanish riding school in Vienna and the Lipizzaners. Tell us about the Lipizzaners. They were descended from these horses originally bred in Spain during the Renaissance. I mean, quite a history.
That's right. So one of the things that always confuses people is, why is the Spanish Riding School of Vienna called the Spanish Riding School?
Yeah.
And the reason is that the horses were originally bred in Spain. And again, you have to look at the history of the cavalry. So we started out in Europe with big, heavy horses that could support a soldier who was wearing a full coat of armor. And in the Renaissance, what happened was that they started to move to a light cavalry, meaning that the soldiers were able to travel farther and faster and wear lighter armor. And the horses that were really key to this change were horses that had come up from, they were horses that had Arabian blood, and they had come up from North Africa and into Spain. And then during the Renaissance, this became the fashionable kind of horse. So almost every principality had a nursery, and the nursery was breeding these Spanish horses. The Lipizzaner were one of these varieties of horses, and originally they were not all white.
Yeah.
They selectively bred them until they bred out the different colors of them. There still are some colored Lipizzaners, and they're considered a sign of good luck.
Huh.
But in general, they were bred so that they eventually, the vast majority of them are white. And these horses, these white horses, were the royal horses of the Habsburg Empire. So they performed actually in private in this Baroque riding hall in Vienna. It was not for public consumption. You could only go if you were invited by the monarch to these private shows. And then they also, slightly heavier but also white horse, drew their coaches. So if you were a citizen of the Habsburg Empire and you saw these white horses go by with the coach, you would know there goes the Habsburg monarchs. So they were symbolically incredibly important. And the Spanish riding school was one of many during the Renaissance. But by the time we get into the 20th century, it really was the last one that was left that taught what was called the art of classical dressage.
Mm-hmm.
And classical dressage were these intricate military maneuvers that had started in antiquity, and they included what was called the airs above the ground.
Right.
And in the airs above the ground, the horses actually assume positions and leap up into the air with a rider on their back. And that art was really only maintained there in the Spanish Riding School. It was the last place that people knew how to do these maneuvers, and the tradition had been passed on from one generation to the next through the years, so making it all the way into the 20th century.
There's a photograph of Podaisky leading a horse through the airs above the ground, I think. Is that the
Yes,
that the
some of them yeah. some of them are done mounted, and some of them are done from the ground. They're just extraordinary to look at, just extraordinary.
Elizabeth Letts is with us. Her book is The Perfect Horse. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Elizabeth Letts. We're talking about her story, The Perfect Horse, the daring U.S. mission to rescue the priceless stallions kidnapped by the Nazis. All right, before we get to the rescue, I want to introduce one more character, at least one anyway, Rudolf Lessing, whom I really loved. He's a German, but he's become disillusioned by the Nazi atrocities. And so he's, I think as you put it in the book, he shifts his alliance from the Führer to the horses. To tell us about Lessing.
Well, Rudolf Lessing was a young man who grew up in Germany, near just east of Berlin, and in an area that had a lot of horses. And he grew up riding horses, like the rest of my characters, loved them very much. He decided he wanted to become a veterinarian. And at the time, he was able to get a scholarship to study veterinary medicine if he would join the army. And he said that his father told him not to do it. He said, "The Nazis want war, and you should not join the army." And Rudolf Lessing said later that he simply ignored his father. He said, "No, I want to be a vet, and I don't believe it. I don't think there's a problem." And in fact, he said that he was a member of the Nazi youth against his father's advice. He just didn't want to listen to him. He joined the army, and he was sent to the Eastern Front, where his job was to take care of horses in field hospitals. And you mentioned at the beginning of the show how many horses there were in World War II, which is something that we simply really haven't thought about very much. People associate horses with World War I, but they don't realize that, especially if you're talking about the Germans and the Russians on the Eastern Front, the horses were pulling the artillery. They were pulling the heavy guns. They were transporting soldiers. Of course, most people know that the conditions on the Eastern Front were terrible, with long distances and not enough food and lots of terrible weather. And so Rudolf Lessing was on the front lines of that. When those horses were wounded or exhausted, dropped from exhaustion, they came to him. And he dug bullets out of horses. And he tried to have them recover from exhaustion. He pulled them out of very often one of the problems with the horses when they were pulling heavy artillery is that they would fall. And especially if it was muddy or something, and then they couldn't get up. They couldn't get the horses up to keep pulling the artillery. Mm. And so that was another thing that he would have to do is go in and see if they would put slings under the horses and try to lift them up. He said he saw horses that were so exhausted that they almost couldn't take another step, that were still having to pull these heavy loads. Mm. And that, being a man who loved horses, that marked him very, very deeply. Well, partway through the war, Rudolf Lessing got a promotion. And the promotion was he went to work as the adjutant to Gustav Rau. Right. So he was kind of Gustav Rau's sidekick. And Gustav Rau had it really good. He had a big, gigantic car and a driver that would take him around to all these horse farms in his empire in Poland, where he had expanded all the way as far as the Ukraine, taking over these horse breeding stations where he was breeding horses for the German war effort. And Rudolf Lessing was with him, and he went with him in his car, and eventually he went with him in his private plane. Lessing's job was to take care of the horses. Yeah. But all of this is taking place in the general government in Poland, which, as many people know, was the part of Poland was really the center of the worst war crimes and atrocities, to the point that one of the horse farms in particular was located on the grounds of Auschwitz. Yeah. And Rudolf Lessing had a front row seat to all of this, and he became extremely disillusioned. And at one point, he went back, and he now recounted talking to his father, who had advised him not to join the army because he didn't like the Nazis, but that his father was very complacent and didn't believe him when he told him the atrocities that he had witnessed firsthand. And so Rudolf Lessing was completely disillusioned from the Nazi cause, but he still felt that he had a very deep duty to care for the horses that were in his charge.
So we fast forward to spring of 1945. And basically what's happening in Europe at this part is the Russians and the American forces are approaching each other. Germany's falling apart. The Lipizzaners had kind of been okay up until this point. But now, I mean, they were on this farm sort of nestled away, which is pretty remarkable, although there's a story connected to that. And Podaisky is kind of preparing for the end. he's hiding equipment, trying to safeguard the horses because he sort of knows what's coming, and they're unsure about the intentions of the Allies or the Russians. The Lipizzaners had been kind of eerily untouched, as you say, by the war. And then this gets us to this story. Hank Reed and the 2nd Cavalry, they're kind of working their way eastward. And tell the story of this photograph, these photographs, because this is sort of where we get to the plan for this rescue.
Right. Well, this is one of these situations where I always love to be a historian and to write nonfiction because, you know, people say truth is stranger than fiction. And this is definitely true. It's just an extraordinary story. The 2nd Cavalry was encamped in Germany, not far from the Czechoslovakian border. They had gone almost all the way across Germany. And they were in a holding pattern when on April 25th, a German officer, he was actually an Air Force officer, arrived at the 2nd Cavalry under white flag, saying that he had to speak to the commanding officer, who was at the time Colonel Hank Reed.
Yeah.
And the intelligence officer who was in charge of briefing him and finding out what he was there for was actually a naturalized Swiss German who had immigrated to the United States, been naturalized, and 2 months later was drafted and was in the army. So he was sort of back on his home turf, and he interviewed this man. And when he opened up the officer didn't want to tell him why he was there. He wanted to speak to the commanding officer, but Spurl, this intelligence officer, opens up his briefcase. Yes, and he finds these pictures of these white horses, and he knows immediately, because everybody knows if there's one thing they know about Colonel Hank Reed, it's that Colonel Hank Reed is mad for horses.
Yeah.
So he takes these pictures of these white horses to Reed and says, you know, we've got this guy here. I don't really know what he wants. He's telling this crazy story, but look at these pictures. Well, you know, there were a lot of people, a lot of Americans in Europe at the time, many of whom, perhaps most of whom, would not have had a clue what they were looking at. Would have just been some pictures of some horses. Hank Reed, though, was a very, very experienced cavalryman. He knew horse flesh, and he saw the horses, and he immediately knew that they weren't any ordinary horses, and that piqued his curiosity.
So we should get General Patton into this story, too. So Reed figures he's in order for them to be able to basically what they do. And I don't want to give too much away about this because it's a terrific read and people should read it. That the Americans, of course, that's what it's about. Help rescue these horses. But they've got to get the sign off from someone up above. And that brings Patton in. And you write this, you say, Reed had this list of people who would agree to something like this. You must be a horse master, a scholar, a high-minded gentleman, a cold-blooded hero, a hot-blooded savage. At one and the same time, you must be a wise man and a fool. And only one person measures up to that. And of course, that's General Patton.
Yeah, that's that quotation. That's Patton's own words when he was writing an article for a cavalry magazine.
Right,
and it was talking about what made a fine cavalryman. And as it happened, so now Reed knows about these horses. He's learned that they're stockpiled. And he's learned that the Germans who are in charge of keeping the horses, among whom, of course, is Rudolf Lessing, have decided that they would rather protect the horses, even if that means committing treason and cooperating with the Germans, than risk that they would be caught in the crossfire and killed. And so, but there's a catch, and the catch is that the horses are in Czechoslovakia, and as you said, they're in this region that is untouched. And it wasn't by mistake that the Germans put the horses there. It was known as the Bohemian Bastion, and the Germans thought that it was the least likely to be attacked from east or west. And sure enough, here it is, the very, very last days of the war, and this little part of Czechoslovakia, Bohemia, it really has made it through the war unscathed. There hasn't been any fighting there. The horses are fine, but with the Russian army advancing, it's not clear how much longer they're going to be safe. And in fact, in particular, it's the Russian army that they're worried about, because the Hungry Red Army, you know, is a big big mass of people, they were slaughtering livestock as they went to feed their troops, including horses. And so that was a very real fear. So Reed, the problem is Reed is a horseman, and he's all for the idea of trying to do something to help the horses. But the horses are in Czechoslovakia, and the German the American army is holding on a line. They're not allowed to advance past it. And, of course, you remember that during World War II, the areas that were going to be Russian sphere and American sphere had already been decided at Yalta. They had already made that determination. So this was already going to be in the Russian sphere. There really was no good reason at all for the Americans to advance in there. But Reed had one ace in the hole. He was part of the Third Army. And the head of the Third Army, of course, was General George Patton. General George Patton was not only a very passionate horseman, he was also a polo player, and he was an old friend of Hank Reed's. I wouldn't know, friend is maybe overstating it, because he's about 20 years older and he was his superior, but they were well acquainted and they liked each other. And Reed felt that he was able to reach out and ask for permission to mount this mission.
And it plays out in the book. I won't, again, give away too much more than that. One of the big questions, though, that comes from the story, and you said that you kind of wanted to work this out in the book, is, you know, we're talking about the last days of the war. Should the army have risked men and resources to rescue these purebred horses? We're talking about at a time when a lot of people were starving and desperate. Mm-hmm. What did you sort of conclude about that question? Because we did end up exerting, you know, a lot of effort to save these horses.
That's such a good question. And I have to say that that is a question that drove me. And I think that in order to answer that question, you have to really look at who these men were and what was important to them. And what they said is that they wanted to do something good, that it was as if the horses helped to remind them what it meant to be a human being, that they were perhaps so worn down by all of the terrible things that they had seen and witnessed and been a party to, that they were having a hard time even really remembering, you know, what it meant to be kind and human. And to be fair, their humanitarian track record was excellent. But there was something about the horses that seemed to give them the feeling of hope, that they could almost imagine maybe that there could be something peaceful and happy in the future.
It's Elizabeth Letts. Her book is The Perfect Horse, The Daring U.S. Mission to Rescue the Priceless Stallions Kidnapped by the Nazis. She joined us from the NPR studios in Culver City, California. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.